Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
The ship was the pride of the American side, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin. As the big freighters go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and good captain well seasoned. Concluding some terms with a couple of steel firms when they left fully loaded for Cleveland. Then later that night when the ship's bell rang, could it be the north wind they'd been feeling?
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. The Great Lakes aren't just beautiful bodies of water. Together, they are the cornerstone of North American commerce. Freighters loaded with cargo travel along the vast watery superhighway. From the late 1950s through 1975, no freighter set more records or commanded more respect than the Edmund Fitzgerald, the largest and most modern ship of its day. 50 years ago, on November 10, 1975, the Fitzgerald sank in Lake Superior during a ferocious storm on its final journey of the season. The wreck and its crew, roughly half from Ohio, are immortalized in the unforgettable Gordon Lightfoot ballad, Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, part of which we were just listening to. And a new book sheds light on the wreck, the dedicated crew, and the loved ones they left behind. Joining us now is New York Times bestselling author John U. Bacon. His latest title is The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Welcome to All Sides, John.
Amy, thank you.
So those of a certain age may best know the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald from that beautiful and haunting ballad of Gordon Lightfoot. It was written months after it sank, and I just played a bit at the top of the show. Ohio is central to the story. I mean, his song even mentions Cleveland. So roughly half of the 29 crew members, all men, came from Ohio. Can you talk a little bit about Ohio's place in this story for the first of us to start?
It is utterly central. Mm-hmm. Michigan gets a lot of credit for its role in it, but only one of the 29 members of the crew came from Michigan, really two-thirds. It's basically one-third Duluth area of Minnesota, what's called the head of the lakes, one-third Toledo area, and one-third Cleveland. Also, the company that ran the ship, the company that owned the ship was based in Milwaukee. That's Northwestern Mutual Insurance. But the company that leased and operated the ship is Ogbe Norton in Cleveland. And Cleveland truly is and has been always the capital of Great Lakes shipping, which I didn't fully appreciate until I started writing the book. So it is central to the story. I will say that when the song says he's going to Cleveland, fully loaded for Cleveland, it's one of the few times he actually was intentionally inaccurate. Mm-hmm. It was fully loaded for Toledo.
Oh, but did Cleveland sound better than Toledo?
A whole lot better, turns out, but there you go.
Okay, well, that's a fun fact for my day. So you've written more than a dozen books on a variety of topics in the past. You've written about sports, history, and more. What made you want to tackle this subject?
The real thing, Amy, embarrassingly, is how little I knew about it. Mm. I grew up in Michigan, in Ann Arbor, I'm sure your favorite city, in Columbus. But I mean, like you guys, I grew up on the Great Lakes. I've been in all the Great Lakes. This is part of your life, naturally. And the song, of course, had in my ears from the time it came out. I was 11 years old when the ship sank and the song came out. But what really drove me is not the whodunit of how it went down, which we certainly spent some time on. I think advance certain theories and diminish others. That usually motivates most of the authors of the previous books. For me, it was what you said earlier, it's the 29 men. Who were they? What are their jobs like? What's life like on deck? What's life like on shore? What are their families like? And why is shipping so important, which I embarrassingly knew almost nothing about? Shipping is crucially important to our lifestyle and our economy, and I knew almost nothing about it.
Same. I virtually knew nothing about the shipping industry in the Great Lakes. I didn't even realize how much commerce is shipped around the Great Lakes. When I think of the Great Lakes, I think of going to the beach at Lake Erie, you know? So I talked to many others. Like, why do you think that is? Why do people not know there's so much shipping around the Great Lakes?
That's a great question. It's one I ask myself repeatedly. Mm-hmm. So just to back it up, shipping is 3 times more efficient than trains and 6 times more efficient than trucks. We see trucks, we see trains, we don't see ships very often. I mean, that's not a 6% or 60% difference. That is a 600% difference. That's a staggering margin, of course. The cement in your basement, the cars in your driveway, the food on your table, it all comes from Great Lakes Shipping, even if you don't live in Ohio. If you live in almost anywhere else, it's still that stuff. This region, by the way, produces more grain, more crops than any other in the world. Germany's second. That's where we stand. So this, we feed the world from these ships, basically. So I'm asking myself the same question you just asked yourself. Why did I not know anything about this? And I think it's a couple reasons. One, there are only 30 crew on a ship on average. And even in the heyday, only 300 ships. That's 9,000 people. Divide that amongst 8 states in the province of Ontario, and that's not very many, of course. And on top of that, even if one of these guys lived next to you, you still wouldn't meet him because he's on a ship. These guys are on a ship 9 months out of the year back then. Back then, no breaks for weddings, graduations, birthdays, and so on. So they're unknown even to their families, in a sense, for 9 months. As one of my experts said, who'd been on a ship for, 45-some years, he said, "I've got 3 great kids. I love them dearly. We're very close now. I didn't teach any of them how to ride a bike or throw a baseball or how to skate." Mm-hmm. That's the lifestyle you'll sign up for. So it is ultimately an invisible industry that we depend on completely.
And I also didn't realize, like, there's a difference between shipping on the Great Lakes and shipping in an ocean. You write that the Great Lakes are actually trickier and more dangerous. Why is that?
That stunned me too. And trust me, Amy, I had to hear it about 10 times before I believe it.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense, right? But here's why. Because salt water is one reason why. The salt water, the waves in the Great Lakes are sharp and pointy like a mountain range, basically, and they're twice as close together. Mm-hmm. On the ocean, the salt blunts the top of that wave, makes a nice smooth roller coaster, and spreads them out. Also, the storms, more importantly, on the oceans, the storms can be 500 or 1,000 miles away. They create the waves that we get on the shore or elsewhere in the ocean. Mm-hmm. So they're nice, smooth roller coasters. And on the Great Lakes, like I said, they're sharp, they're pointy, because they're produced by, what did the guy say? He said, locally occurring storm systems. Mm. I said, what does that mean? He goes, it's right over your damn head. So what happens is the waves on the ocean are 10 to 16 seconds apart. The waves on the Great Lakes are 4 to 8 seconds apart. Why does that matter? Because they're close enough with a 700-foot ship. You can have your bow stuck in one wave 30 feet high, and your stern stuck in another wave 30 feet high, right, with nothing in between, which means you're carrying 26,000 tons of iron ore. That means it's going to sag or snap, all right, and then it's going to hog, do the opposite over the next wave, and then sag and hog and sag and hog. It happens 10,000 times a day during a storm. Mm-hmm. Take a paperclip and bend it back and forth 10,000 times. It's going to snap, and these ships actually snap in one last snap before we move on. From 1875 to 1975, there were 6,000 shipwrecks, commercial shipwrecks, on the Great Lakes. That's one per week, every week, for a century. And all the guys told me the ocean isn't even close.
Wow. That seems like a high number. We'll get into that a little bit more because you uncovered kind of some of the things that went wrong and changes that were made after the Edmund Fitzgerald. But this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about a new book, The Gales of November. It's about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and we're talking with its author, New York Times bestselling author, John U. Bacon. I guess we need to explain who the real Edmund Fitzgerald was. Who was he, and how did he get a ship named after him?
Well, he's a real person. And by the way, people listen to the song, as we've talked about. I still encounter people who think either the song was fictional or it's the 1850s. So, no, Edmund Fitzgerald was alive in our time. In 1958, he was the CEO of Northwestern Mutual Insurance. And you think, why is he going to commission a ship for $84 million? And the reason is his grandfather was a Great Lakes captain, and his 5 great uncles were all Great Lakes captains. That's 6 in one family. There are only 300. That's 2% of the total in one family. That has to be a record. So he's from this background. And he had 2 edicts. One that would be the finest ship on the Great Lakes, and it was, as you pointed out earlier on in your great introduction. Mm. The longest, one of the fastest, carried the most load, set all the records, as you said, repeatedly. And 2, that they not name the ship after him.
Oh, and he did not want to name that. All right, got it.
A, he's humble, and B, knows that these ships do go down. Like I said, at incredible rates. But they got him out of the boardroom at some point for some excuse and voted behind his back 8-0 to name it after him despite his wishes. So there's your background.
And I'm guessing that after it sunk, he was again saying, oh, I wish it wasn't named for me.
Well, his son said the best day of his life was June 7th, 1958, when they launched the ship in Detroit with 15,000 fans, more than the Detroit Tigers drew, by the way, at that time. And the worst day of his life was November 10th, 1975, when it went down, and he never shook it.
Oh. The Gordon Lightfoot song that I played at the beginning, Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, it is its own fascinating tale. And how it came to be is an unlikely hit. And you were able to interview one of the original band members. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I just kept getting lucky as far as people still being alive, who wrote the articles, who wrote the songs, the family members, the bartenders. I got two bartenders who serve the crew. That's incredible. But anyway, yes, I got to Barry Keane, the drummer of the Gordon Lightfoot Band. This is an unlikely hit, to say the least. Gordon Lightfoot, a great Great Lakes sailor, by the way, very experienced, was writing the song The Night It Went Down, based on an old Irish sea shanty. He had no words, of course, but then the articles come in. And he felt this is worthy of his time, basically, and wanted to honor the men. So he writes this song, but he plays it for nobody. And they're recording the song in March of 1976 in Toronto. And they've got 5 days to record 11 songs for his new album, Summertime Dreams. But this song is not one of them. He's never played with anyone else. So they finish their work in 3.5 days. They finish early and tight band. And he's literally saying thank you to all the band members who are clicking their guitar cases and going home. And then the producer comes on over the PA system and says, why don't you try that song you've been screwing around with? And he said, it's not ready, because he's a perfectionist. And he says, look, man, I'm charging you for 5 days, whether you play 5 days or not. I'm here right now. You know how production goes. The band is here right now. This is not happening next week, so give it a shot. So he gets talked into it. He asks for the lights to be dimmed down. He's quiet for a minute, trying to recapture the mood that he wanted. And then the drummer, Barry Keane, says, you know, what do you want me to do? He's never heard the song, doesn't even know if there are drums in it. And he says, I'll give you a nod when I get to your part. Okay. After a minute and a half, he's still not gotten to him. And he figures this song, he forgot all about me. The song's about to end, because 2 minutes is about all songs went at that time. And nope, at 1:34 exactly, he turns over and nods to Barry Keane, who very courageously, in my opinion, comes in with a very strong drum fill. That's the thunder coming in, the storm. And you can't hear the song without it. It's very distinctive. They keep on going for 6 minutes, 28 seconds. They finish. And they said, you know what? That wasn't half bad. Let's try it for real. Okay. They tried it for four or five more times that afternoon. Not as good. They come back the next day, their off day. They try it 10 more times. Not as good. And then the producer says, you know what? I recorded that first time. Want me to play it back? And he does. And they all agree that was the best version. And Barry Keane told me he's been on 500 albums. He said, I have, you know, seen first takes maybe, you know, 5-10 times. This is not a first take. This is the first time anybody ever played it. That happens never, ever, ever. And I said, why did it happen this time? He said, this is not a song that you think your way through. This is a song you got to feel. And if you feel it strongly, the listener will too. And that's why the song you've been hearing for 50 years is the first time anybody ever played it.
Wow. Well, you're going to hear more of the song throughout the course of the hour. But something you said earlier relates back to the song. Because on first listen of the song, if you don't know about the Edmund Fitzgerald, I would have thought it happened in the 1800s, maybe early 1900s, kind of like Titanic sinking time. So a lot of people felt similarly to me. So around the 50th anniversary, which was November 10th of this year, social media memes began popping up all over TikTok and Instagram of, like, really young people discovering this song and the Edmund Fitzgerald. In one, a man wore a Halloween costume with a small replica of the Fitzgerald boat around his waist and went into a swimming pool and tipped over. And then in another, a guy on TikTok gives a dramatic rendition.
The gales of November did come early. A ship tried and true, loaded with 26,000 tons of iron ore.
Swallowed.
By the fury of Lake Superior, her most formidable
29 souls they ring her bell for every year.
I do not laugh in the face of that frigid water. 3 stories high, coming down on the bow, buckling the
sinister. 729 feet of steel hull devoured by Kichigumi faster than you can watch an Instagram reel.
So what did you think of this 50th anniversary and all of this trending on social media, the Edmund Fitzgerald kind of having a viral moment?
For the most part, positively. In a few cases, including the costume, I think it's worth remembering that 29 souls did go down. And I'm reminded of that weekly when I continue to talk to the family members. And as Heidi Wilhelm Brabon told me, she's a 12-year-old girl. When the ship goes down, that's her dad on that ship, Blaine Wilhelm. And she said, you know, you don't get over this, you get used to it. You know, something being silly or trivial, I might take exception. The flip side is, and this is the positive part, and we've been, frankly, pleasantly surprised with the sales on this in terms of we knew we had to get Great Lake Dads. If we didn't get that, we're not going to sell very many books. What surprised us is the geographical spread as well as the demographic spread. This book right now is in the 8 independent bookstore regions of the country. We're number one in 4 of them. New England, the Pacific Northwest, the Colorado Rockies, and the Great Lakes and Midwest. That shows you this TikTok phenomenon. And maybe more surprisingly, if you get on Goodreads.com, women are out reviewing men like 3-1, which, you know, again, we thought was a dad book. And that has also pleasantly surprised us. So where the family members I know are deeply pleased is that this story is not dying here. It's expanded to a whole new generation, which, again, you could not have predicted.
And do you also think that a lot of people are like me who really didn't realize that this was only 50 years ago?
Amy, I can back it up empirically. I was just in Cleveland at the Great Lakes Brewery. They, of course, produced the Edmund Fitzgerald Porter. When I went there with the family's permission, I started out in the Cuyahoga Library on October 6th, and some 30 or 40 events, every single event, we get between 50 and 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. Every single event, at least a few people tell me, I did not know the song was real, or I didn't know it was 1975. So, Amy, you're in excellent company.
All right. Well, coming up, the fateful final journey of the Edmund Fitzgerald, we're going to talk about what went wrong. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
The wind and the wires made a tattletale sound, and the wave broke over. Every man knew as the captain did too, 'twas the witch of November come stealing. The dawn came late and the breakfast had to wait, when the gales of November came slashing. When afternoon came it was freezing rain, in the face of a hurricane west wind.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. November 9th, 1975, in Superior, Wisconsin, it started out as an unseasonably warm day. Temperatures in the 70s in the late autumn. And storms were brewing elsewhere, but nothing out of the ordinary, according to the National Weather Service. But as Gordon Lightfoot wrote in his famous song, which we just listened to, the gales of November came early. By November 10th, it was anything but calm. And that change in the weather changed the lives of 29 men and their families forever, when the greatest vessel in the Great Lakes sank. Still with us is John Eubacon, author of the new book, The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Thanks again for being here today, John.
Thank you, Amy.
So I wanted to talk about, you know, when Gordon Lightfoot wrote the song, you know, everyone was listening to it, but then for Gordon Lightfoot's song, is that the inspiration for your title? Is that where you got the title from?
Oh, not only did I was inspired by that, I paid for it.
Oh, got it.
I had to buy the rights to the song for this purpose. Does not mean I have complete and total rights to go out and sing it. But yes, that was a no-brainer on that one. And by the way, of the 20 books behind me on this topic, I think every single one borrows a line from the song. That's how much the song imprints this whole story. And let's be honest, without the song, there is no book.
So I was explaining the weather a little bit, where it was like really warm, and then all of a sudden there was this storm. Can you talk a little bit about weather data from 50 years ago? Like, what did the crew know about the storm?
Very little. And trust me when I tell you, there's more information on your iPhone right now than there is in that captain's house in 1975. But even at the time, the forecasting was good enough and the communications were good enough. All sides could have done a much better job of informing Captain McSorley, Ernest McSorley, about what was going to happen. So they were poorly informed, sadly. So, as you said, it was very warm on Sunday in Duluth, in Superior, Wisconsin, on November 9th. That's bad news, actually, because the longer winter takes to arrive, the angrier it shows up. So it's like water behind a dam, and the more water there is, the worse it's going to be. So you've got one storm coming in from Alberta, Canada, called the Alberta Clipper, bringing cold, dry air, and they're used to that. There's a second storm coming out from the southwest, which they really didn't know about. They should have. That was bringing hot, wet air, and these set up shop, they collide right in front of Whitefish Bay, which Gordon Lightfoot mentions. Whitefish Bay is the drain of the bathtub that is Lake Superior. So if you can get there, you're safe. That's the whole idea. And these two storms set up shop like a catcher guarding home plate right in front of Whitefish Bay, and that's where they're headed.
Now, the captain has more than one route available to choose from. Does he pick one for any certain reason of where the ship's going to go that day?
Trust your listeners, by the way, that Amy does her homework. She knows what she's talking about. And yes, almost always you take what's called the southern route, which means hugging the lower shore of Lake Superior, the Michigan side, if you will. In this case, he decides to take the northern route, and that was very unusual for him. The northern route basically means you're doing three sides of a rectangle and the long way, basically. So you get the lee, the protection of the Canadian shore, which means the winds are less and therefore the waves are less. But it comes with three catches. One, it's pay me now or pay me later. The first two legs are great. The third side of that rectangle is going to be hell because now you're coming down the eastern shore of Lake Superior. The winds now have 350 miles of Lake Superior to build the waves. You're at one end of your bathtub, you start splashing around. Where's going to be the worst? By the drain, of course. So, same idea. Second thing is, it's 14 hours longer than the southern route. All right, no big deal normally, except that in this case, you've allowed that southern storm a 14-hour head start to set up shop before you get there. There's two problems. Third problem is, he does not know it nearly as well. I got to six crew members who'd been on the ship, obviously before it went down, to that season. And they all said the same thing. We never once took the northern route. So they take the southern route 50 times a year, and really 100 if you account round trips. He knows he's taken that thousands of times in his 32 years as a captain. He knows all the islands, all the currents, all the dangers. This northern route, he really doesn't, and that creates problems.
The captain of the Edmund Fitzgerald, Ernest McSorley, he plans to retire after this final trip. And he didn't even have to make the trip. He had already met his quota for the season. So, what do we know why he made this one last trip?
Yes, great captain by all accounts, the best in the Great Lakes, and also, unlike most captains of his era, he was not a tyrant, not Captain Bligh. His crew would follow him from ship to ship to ship, as he was promoted. They loved him. So five guys on that ship, according to guys I talked to, were planning to retire after that season. And as you correctly point out, they're going to retire the previous trip. And he tacks one more on this trip to earn his cargo bonus, because his wife Nellie in Toledo is in 24-hour health care, and I believe has cancer at that time. I couldn't quite nail that down. This is a noble mission, and it makes it all the more heartbreaking.
I wanted to talk more about some of the men that you highlight throughout the book. There's a trio from Ohio that you spend some time on. Can you tell me the story of Bruce Hudson, who was 22?
Yes. Bruce Hudson from North Olmsted, Ohio, a Cleveland suburb. I had two sides to him. He was in the band and an Eagle Scout, but he also had a motorcycle and a girlfriend. So he was a bit of both, I guess. Had a wild side, had a very upright side, I guess. But anyway, he's going to The Ohio State University, as it's now called, as you know. as a proud graduate yourself. And he drops out for 2 years to make real money as a deckhand. Even though a deckhand is the lowest ranking on the ship, those guys back then made 3 or 4 times what a teacher made then. And these days, it'd be about the equivalent of $180,000 a year for 9 months' work. So you can see the temptation there. He was very good about saving his money and getting overtime and bonuses and whatnot. He had one indulgence, and that was his 1972 Dodge Challenger muscle car, a beautiful burgundy piece of work with a sticker with the logo for the Emmett Fitzgerald in the rear passenger window. So that's how proud he was of it. And he's going to go on a trip with Mark Thomas, also from Cleveland, across the country. They're going to go to Colorado to get some Coors beer back when that was exotic, swear to God.
Oh, wow. Fancy.
Exactly. I know that'll date everything, but anyway. And then go to LA and then do all that and come back around Route 66. And of course, his plans change a little bit in September when his girlfriend, Cindy Reynolds, a waitress in Toledo, calls him up and says, when he's in Silver Bay, Minnesota, and says, "Guess what? I'm pregnant." And he's got to think fast. So he says, "Don't worry about it. We'll move in together. We'll raise the child ourselves. We got plenty of money. We'll be okay." And she's very relieved about this. And she tells him, "You know what? Go ahead and go on your trip anyway. That's November." The car is waiting for them 3 days later in Toledo, by the way. Hmm. That's in November. The child's not due until June. And so at that point, they're probably going to get married. But he's headed for the biggest year of his life.
And also the captain, who we just mentioned, Ernest McSorley, he was an Ohioan as well, right?
Correct. He lived in Ottawa Hills, Toledo, one of the fancier suburbs there. I've seen his house, a beautiful colonial with pillars and so on. Mm-hmm. And Nellie was his second wife, and she had 3 children that he was the adopted father of. Mm-hmm.
Is there any other person from Ohio you'd like to highlight before we move on to something else?
Oh, sure. I mentioned Mark Thomas a little bit.
Yeah, go ahead.
He was the buddy of Bruce Hudson. Eddie Bindon, also from the Cleveland area, was 47 years old. He and Helen married 25 years, no kids. He was the first assistant chief engineer, a high-ranking guy. But he was about to retire after that trip also. And for reasons I can't explain, Amy, the day before they left on November 8th, 1975, he gets a ride somehow to Duluth, Minnesota, right next door to Superior, to a jewelry store, buys her a 2-carat diamond ring to celebrate their 25th anniversary. He's about to retire also in 3 days. She's going to be on the dock in Toledo to greet him. Mm-hmm. And yet, instead of stuffing that ring in his duffel bag like you normally would, he gives it to a friend of his with a love note wrapped around it and says, "Please mail this to my wife." Mm-hmm. And only Eddie Bindon knows why, but we know, of course, what happens. His ship goes down, and a few days later, she receives in the mail a 2-carat diamond ring for their 25th anniversary and a love note. And she wears that the rest of her life, and she never remarries.
Wow. That's kind of wild to think about now. He trusted the Postal Service more than that ship or something. We don't know why. Yeah, I guess.
Exactly. Who knows?
Can you explain a little bit to me the size of the Fitzgerald? Like, how much cargo can it hold? Because I mentioned that it was the largest and most powerful and did the most cargo shipping. But, like, can you describe it for our audience?
Sure, and it kind of needs to be because the scale of everything in Great Lakes shipping is very hard to get your head around. Lake Superior itself is bigger than Ireland, so that's what you're dealing with. You can't see across either side when you're in the middle of it. Mm. But anyway, this ship was 729 feet. How long is that? It's 1 foot short of the Detroit Renaissance Center, which is the biggest building between Toronto and Chicago. And yet, it's only 75 feet wide. That is less than the space between home plate and first base. Hmm. And why is that? The Sioux locks. So these things are designed like pencils, basically, which is a crazy. Only ships like it in the world are designed like this. It's because of maximum cargo and the Sioux locks. They were carrying 26,000 long tons. That's an imperial measure. It's even more. Long tons of iron ore, taconite pellets, which is a way they pelletize iron ore. That is the equivalent of 4,200 adult elephants. Again, staggering weight.
Okay.
There's enough iron on each load, and they do this 50 times a year. Each load can build 7,000 cars. That's what these guys do. So that's how mind-blowing all this is.
Wait, how many cars? Say the number again.
7,000.
Wow.
Per trip.
Per trip, okay.
They do it 50 times a year.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with John U. Bacon, author of The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Now, there is also like a line of how much cargo freighters are allowed to carry. And it's supposed to be a hard and fast rule. But does the Fitzgerald break this rule? Is it carrying too much on this trip?
Only every single trip.
Oh, okay.
So, yes, Plimsoll was a British politician in the 1840s, 1850s, the Dickensian era, of course. The line is designed to make sure that ships are not overloaded. In Great Britain, as well as elsewhere, that the owners would overload the ships and insure them so they'd get more money when everyone dies than if they would if the ship made it safely to their next port, which is a very nasty little game. So Plimsoll made the Plimsoll line. It's painted and now it's welded on these ships. That's how far down your ship can go in the water and still sail safely. And it matters because you don't get insured unless it's otherwise. So these guys cheated in that line. There are a lot of ways to do it very cleverly. You hose down the deck when it's hot and the middle of the ship comes up and you save 2 or 3 inches. 2 or 3 inches is literally hundreds of tons of taconite. That's what these margins are. So they cheated in this line like everyone else did, frankly, but also in their defense, the Coast Guard and the American Shipping Board, it's crazy. In 1969, 71, and 73, they allowed this ship to go from 14 feet above water to 11 feet above water. Mm. So these guys are trying to nickel and dime an inch here or there, and the government says, take 3 more feet. And it was not designed for that. The engineers did not design this ship for what it was carrying for the last 6, 7 years of its life. And trust me, it takes a toll. Mm.
So the Fitzgerald is not the only ship to leave that day. So, and this made me think, like, how everyone knows the name of the Titanic but can't remember the name of the ship, the other ship that's out there. So this is the Arthur M. Anderson. How does this ship, there's a note in here, the Arthur M. Anderson, not the accounting firm. How does
True.
Yes, okay. So how does that
Unrelated.
Ship, yeah, how does the Anderson try to help the Fitzgerald, and why is it not able to?
Well, these are cousin ships. They're about the same size, doing the same job, basically. The captains are friends. They're always in competition to get there first, naturally. But the Anderson travels with it on the northern route. So these guys are parallel pretty much the whole trip. On the last leg, as I said, the third leg down that three sides of a rectangle, M. Fitzgerald, Ernest McSorley, is competitive. He does go full blast, while the Anderson was not. So they're about an hour ahead. But at some point during this crazy storm, and now you've got 60-mile-per-hour winds and 30-foot waves, they lose their long radar, their short radar, the lighthouse at Whitefish Point. This is the one you're trying to get to, safety. Mm-hmm. That light goes out. The radio beacon from that lighthouse also goes out. So you're basically sailing blind. So luckily, the Arthur Anderson is helping it guide in. And the Fitzgerald waits more or less about an hour for the Arthur Anderson to catch up to basically guide it in. So the Anderson was very helpful to the Fitzgerald throughout the process.
Mm. But it wasn't, did the Anderson know the Fitzgerald had gone down? Like, I guess if it was really dark, what was known there?
Well, you're guessing.
Yeah.
A few things. One, they saw on the radar, Bernie Cooper, the captain of the Anderson, sees on the radar the Fitzgerald go over a patch of land called Six Fathom Shoal. This is where, again, he did not know the northern route. Mm-hmm. So you got this little island called Caribou Island. It's 1 mile by 3 mile. There are no caribou on it. It's all just swamps and flies, and even the caribou took off, apparently, decades ago. But in front of that is Six Fathom Shoal, and that has a fathom is 6 feet, so this is 36 feet deep, which is nowhere near anywhere you should be, of course, in a ship like that. And in some places, it's only 11 feet deep. So the Anderson sees the Fitzgerald, they're convinced, go over that patch. Whether or not the M. Fitzgerald was even aware of that is not entirely clear, incredibly. But anyway, so now it's taken on water. So now when the ship goes down at 7:10, the M. Fitzgerald, of course, no radar, no radio communications, no lights on the horizon. He can't say for sure it's gone, but he's pretty sure it's gone. So he reports that to the Coast Guard in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. And then 2 hours later, when the Anderson gets into Whitefish Bay, after surviving the craziest storm of anyone's life on that ship, and I talked to Rick Barthuli, who'd been on that ship that night, they feel the ship turn around, and they know what they're doing. They're going back out, having just saved their own lives to get into port. The Coast Guard asked them to go back out to look for the Fitzgerald. The Coast Guard ships cannot go out that night. So the Anderson goes back out, and this is a fool's mission. Mm-hmm. They know damn well you don't lose 729 feet of steel out of nowhere. That ship has gone down. You might find a few guys in a life raft, perhaps, that has happened in the past with the Bradley and the Morrell decades earlier. But they know it's a fool's mission, and they go anyway. And I asked Rick Barthuli, who was on the ship that night, I said, why'd you do it? He said, we know it's a bad idea, and we know we could go down also. He said, but they would have done it for us, and that is the sailor's code. And that, to me, is quite noble.
Do we the radio transmissions of Captain McSorley don't really reveal much. Is there like a black box recording, kind of like they have in airplanes? I mean, do we know, did he say Mayday, you know, or anything like that?
No, there is not back then. There is now, I believe. But anyway, no. At 7:10, the last communication we know of, he is complaining to Bernie Cooper about certain problems he's got. The fence railing is down, probably been blown up for God knows what reason. Two vent covers been blown off. Then he mentions in passing the first time that he's got a starboard list. That means you're leaning permanently to the right. And that's a problem because you can't steer very well with that. You're more likely to capsize. You're already halfway there. Or get pinned down by a wave or cracked in half. You're like a three-legged animal in the wild. You're in trouble at that point. When they talk again a few hours later, that's the first thing that McSorley mentions. So you can assume it's probably getting worse. And then at 7:10, when Cooper asks him, how are you making out with your problems? Ernest McSorley says, and I quote, we are holding our own. And those are the last words from anybody on the M.F. Fitzgerald. And no, by the way, to answer your next question, there was no Mayday. So we disagree about a lot of things. People debate what happened and when. But everyone agrees whatever happened, happened fast. Because this guy is said to be the best captain of the Great Lakes. There is no Mayday, as you say. There's no SOS. The lifeboats and life rafts are not released. Only one crew member we know of is even wearing a life jacket. So whatever happened, happened very quickly.
We are talking with the author of The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And coming up, we are going to talk about the aftermath and how the wreck changes the shipping industry. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down at the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Durovich. 50 years ago, the Edmund Fitzgerald sank in a ferocious storm on its final journey of the season. The wreck and its crew, roughly half from Ohio, are immortalized in the unforgettable Gordon Lightfoot ballad, Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, which we were just listening to. We're talking this hour with New York Times bestselling author John U. Bacon about his new book, The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Thanks again for being here, John.
Thank you, Amy.
So your book really excels at keeping the personal stories front and center. You don't want to lose the sight of the human toll of what happened. I wanted to bring in a couple of voices of the adult children of the men on the Edmund Fitzgerald. They were interviewed along with you as a part of a 2025 documentary on the Edmund Fitzgerald that aired in Detroit. First, you're going to hear from Heidi Wilhelm Braben. And who was one of the seven children, and then you're going to hear Tom Walton, one of the four sons left fatherless.
Kids at school didn't understand, you know, why my dad wasn't around. And I said, well, he's got a job, just like everybody, you know, most dad, you know. He just happened to work on a ship and not on the farm or in factory or like that. That was just his job.
When my dad was home for a short time in the winter, that the lakes were frozen, he was lost. He didn't take a part-time job or anything. He just sat around the house. He couldn't wait to get back out on the water. So consequently, the four of us never got to know him as closely as we would have liked.
Can you tell us more, John, about, you know, the circumstances of finding families to talk to for your book? Was everyone willing to talk to you?
Not at first, and I understand that. They had never talked to any author before. Their stories are very private, of course. These are not celebrities or politicians or wealthy people and so on. They're hardworking, middle-class folks. But I got lucky a few times. Bruce Lynn, another proud Ohio State graduate, he was the director of, still is, of the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum at Whitefish Point. That's where the bell from the ship itself is now displayed. He knew the families very well, very close to them. They all come back every year for the anniversaries. And we got along, and he trusted me, and he asked the families to trust me also, and they did. And I'm pleased to report they're very happy with the book. That went very well. But that is the untold story from my point of view. I got to half the family members, 14 of the 29, and six people had been on the ship before, as I said. So they were reluctant at first, and now I consider ourselves pretty good friends.
And going back to when the ship went down, you know, how were the Fitzgerald families finding out? Because this is 1975. There's no cell phones or social media to spread the word instantly. So how did the families find out that something went wrong?
The hardest way possible. The company that, again, operated and leased the ship, Ogilvie Norden, based in Cleveland. And I will say, too, this is how all the companies did it back then. So it's not unique to them. But they did not call anybody. They did not answer the phone when anybody called, and they did not return any phone calls. So pretty heartbreaking. They found out from Dennis Anderson on Channel 10 in Duluth. They found out from WTOL in Toledo, Channel 11, which I grew up watching. They found out in the case of Ruth Hudson, the mother of Bruce Hudson. She's on her way Tuesday morning, November 11th, to her job at the Bonnie Bell Cosmetic Factory in Cleveland when she finds out that her only child, on the ship, that his ship went down from the radio. That's pretty cruel.
So Ruth Hudson, you mentioned Bruce earlier. Bruce is the one whose girlfriend shares a surprise pregnancy right before he gets on the ship. And so Ruth Hudson is Bruce's mother, and she's one of the ones who really pushes to memorialize the crew and protect their final resting place. Talk about how she did that.
Sure. She and Cheryl Rosema, must be said, did a great job on this. They realize at some point that the video, the searchers, the divers are coming down, some commercial, who are taking photos of dead crewmen, putting them online, videos and so on, taking taconite from the final load as souvenirs and whatnot. And that naturally rubbed them the wrong way, and appropriately so. So they had to appeal to the Canadian government. This ship is just barely in Canadian waters. So they're talking to Ottawa and Toronto quite often, Toronto being the capital of Ontario. And this is, you know, the old days, no internet, no email. These are calls and letters and meetings by car and whatnot. And she has not got a ton of money, so this is a considerable cost. But they do get, in 1995, the Canadian government to agree that this is an international gravesite and nobody can dive down there to this day without the permission of the Canadian government. And they also got the bell brought up, which is no small trick, from 530 feet below. Had that removed from the ship and brought up to the museum at Whitefish Point. So two very noble missions.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald 50 years ago with John Eubacon, author of the book The Gales of November. So the Fitzgerald was also known as the Fitz. So why it was considered to be the best ship on the Great Lakes. So what was the reaction to the fact that the greatest ship on the Great Lakes went down? Like, thoughts on that?
I mean, truly shattering, like Titanic going down, essentially. I didn't realize what a big deal the ship was long before it went down until I started my research. This was Titanic of its time for Great Lakes shipping. It was so shocking, and I think the song helped a great deal, that it kind of embarrassed the industry to quit being so complacent. They could have, in 1975, forecast these storms better, communicated them better to the captains, and they failed to do so. So forecasting has gotten much better, communication has gotten much better, and good old basic common sense. If you look at the photo of yours truly in the back flap of the book, I'm there in Whitefish Point on November 11th, last year, 2024. about 30 or 40 mile per hour winds is why I'm wincing in the wind. My hair is blowing, of course. And about 10 foot waves. Every single ship on my phone program, you can track these ships, every single ship, all these ore carriers and whatnot, they're there in Whitefish Bay anchored. Mm. And I guarantee you, Amy, that 50 years earlier, none of them would have been. So common sense has finally gotten to the companies and the captains. Don't go out in this stuff. And I told you an earlier crazy stat of how 6,000 ships had gone down the previous century, mm-hmm. from 1875 to 1975. That is, by the way, the low estimate, incredibly. Mm. Some say 10,000, some say 25,000. Let's call it 6,000. That's one per week. Since November 10th, 1975, how many commercial shipwrecks have there been? Zero, not one. And that's almost as crazy as the first stat. And it's all because of the Edmund Fitzgerald. After Titanic, you get more lifeboats on ships. It wakes you up. And one of my experts said, when do you fix anything? When it's broken. Mm. And this ship going down told the whole industry, this is broken. And the families, by the way, are very aware of this fact and take great pride in the idea that they suffered, but their suffering means that no one else has suffered since in the same way.
But with those 6,000 ships that went down, did people die over the course of those many years with those 6,000 ships?
How about this? The estimate is 30,000 crew dead. That's one per day every day for a century. Mm. So 30,000 for a century, that's the low estimate again. And since then, zero. Mm. Pretty incredible.
Is the bottom of Lake Superior just littered with old ships that have gone down?
At least 6,000.
Okay.
So I can tell you this. There's a brisk cottage industry of divers, and certainly in Cleveland, Toledo, they do this. And many of them are not that far offshore. So if they're not, you know, if they're 50 or 60 feet deep, and Lake Erie is very good for that compared to Lake Superior. Mm-hmm. These ships are being discovered. New ships are being discovered on the bottom every year on the Great Lakes.
You mentioned that there are some survivors who struggled. Survivors, I guess, being people who knew them or maybe were supposed to be on the boat. Can you talk about some of that?
Sure. Patrick Devine, his dad was a noted judge in Toledo and a big wheel in the Democratic Party. He went to Marquette University and dropped out to be a deckhand on 10 different ships, including the Edmund Fitzgerald that summer of 1975. Became a good friend of Paul Ripa's, a fellow deckhand out of Ashtabula, Ohio, and the other guys. And he gets bumped back when Bruce Hudson's back is fixed again. Bruce Hudson is back on the ship. And you find out an hour before you get dumped, basically, in Ashtabula. Bruce Hudson gets on the ship, and Patrick Devine gets off the ship. They never met. They never would meet, of course. And then 2 months later, the ship goes down. Mm-hmm. When he got bumped from the ship, Patrick Devine was quite upset about this. He loved the job. It was good money. He thought this is the best deal possible. And it took him about 10 years, he told me, and, you know, drinking and whatnot, to make some peace with this, basically. And he's the one that took me a year to reach him. It took me another year to sit down and talk with him. And now I think we're pals as well. But his testimony from those trips is invaluable. And also, by the way, he brought Paul Ripa, for me at least, back to life. Not obviously literally. I knew almost nothing about him. I knew nothing about Eddie Bindon. So his testimony to me for the book allows a whole new generation on TikTok and elsewhere to know about these, I think, very good guys.
How many years did you spend working on this book?
Yeah, you got it.
All the years.
So my previous books, often about, yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. right. Previous books often about Big Ten football, and I sat down with Urban Meyer and guys like that for these books. They were very helpful to me. Those usually take me like a year and change. Mm-hmm. And this one took me almost 4 years. And I was asking my wife, why is this taking me so long? She said, oh, that's easy. You didn't know anything. Mm-hmm. I thought I did, but I didn't. So this one was a much bigger investment, but that's what it took.
Mm-hmm. And we mentioned Ruth Hudson earlier, and we've talked about the Gordon Lightfoot song several times. But there's a photo in the book of Gordon Lightfoot on the phone with Ruth Hudson. Like they knew each other. Tell me about that.
It's not a fancy photo, but it makes the point. So Ruth Hudson, as her niece Pam told me, she's 4'9", and she told you she's 5'5", and you believed her. So she's a spark plug.
Okay.
High school graduate, but very well read, very intelligent. She obviously lost her only son, and then she finds out 6 months later from Cindy Reynolds that she's going to be a grandmother out of nowhere. She did not expect that. So, and then that daughter, Heather, has four children. Austin looks apparently just like Bruce Hudson. So she told Pam Wittig, her niece, that I love all my kids the same, but I play favorites and Austin's it. So That's a gift back to her, I guess. But she became very close to Gordon Lightfoot. Gordon Lightfoot changed the lyrics of the song a couple times as he learned more, including changing about the hatch covers, the cargo hatches breaking in. They didn't. And that exonerates her son, Bruce. They became very close. Gordon Lightfoot was great to the families. He knew them all, brought them all backstage. So he goes in on the 40th anniversary in 2025. I'm sorry, 2015. Mm. He goes in on the 40th anniversary with Rick Haynes, the bass player. And it's not on the way to anywhere. And there's no media there. They're just there to pay their respects to the families. And he walks in the kitchen of the Cruise quarters where the family stay when they're in town. And he says to Pam Wittig, the niece of Aunt Ruth, he says, "Where's Aunt Ruth?" Because she's the fire plug, of course. And she says she's on her deathbed back in South Carolina. And Gordon Lightfoot says, "Give me a phone." So he talks to Ruth Hudson on her deathbed. And she says, "I promised Bruce, her son, by prayer, that I would be with him before the 40th anniversary in heaven because he's been alone too long." Mm-hmm. And she tells Bruce Gordon Lightfoot this. And then 3 hours later, that's exactly what she did. She passed away and joined her son, Bruce. And that's the photo you have in the book.
We're going to close this hour listening to a little bit more of Gordon Lightfoot's Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. We've been talking with New York Times bestselling author John U. Bacon, the author of The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Thank you for joining us today, John.
Amy, thank you.
And thank you to producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz for producing today's show.
With a crew and good captain, well seasoned.